The following programming is sponsored by MBC Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Stand by, fire!
Here we are again live from 860 AM WWDB Radio. The big guns wake everybody up. This is Project Chaos Radio Show number 1616. We've called Man in the Arena after the famous speech, and we're going to talk about that. But there's a lot more to get to. Big date in history today, April 29th. First, I want to take you back 79 years to 1945. If you don't know, the world had been mired down in the bloody World War for six long years. Estimates say it would cost $16 trillion today, but that doesn't account for all the private losses. The whole endeavor was a huge reduction in wealth and the loss of human life astonishing. The Soviet Union lost between 20 and 27 million people. China, 15 to 20 million people, Germany, 6 to 7 million, Poland, 6 million, Dutch East Indies, 3 to 4 million, Japan, 3 million, India, 3 million, Yugoslavia, 2 million, French Indochina, 2 million, and France, 600,000. That doesn't even name it all. All that money, all that loss of life from World War, one World War. The Soviet Union was estimated to have suffered the highest number of World War II casualties. As many as 27 million Soviets lost their lives, as many as 11 million military deaths, joined by 10 million civilian deaths in the Soviet Union alone, possibly an additional 8 to 9 million deaths due to famine and disease. And those totals don't include the more than 14 million Soviet soldiers who were wounded during the war. Think about the burden that that country carried. China, similar story, had a second highest number of total casualties, as many as 20 million people, 4 million military deaths, 18 million civilian deaths. Both China and the Soviet Union were so racked by famine and disease during the war that some experts believe that countries' civilian casualty numbers may have been significantly underestimated. There was dead bodies everywhere. We were just talking about this before the show. Germany incurred the third most casualties of World War II, with 7 to 8 million people dying. Poland, whose death toll includes an estimated 3.2 million Jewish civilians who died in Nazi concentration and death camps. And I want to talk about that a little bit as well. The United States lost over 400,000, minuscule in comparison, but still huge burden for our country to bear. And the result was a total transformation of world power, as you know, which I guess benefited the United States. But the destruction to get there, certainly no glorious path. And if you really step back and look at it, in many ways, World War II was a total collapse of the entire world, 70 to 80 million people in total dying. All these countries were great superpowers, and look at what happened. I say this to let it be a reminder of what we see going on today. But let's stick with the story for a second. In 1945, things were changing quickly. January, Soviet forces began liberating Auschwitz. Auschwitz was the first camp to be liberated. American forces were liberating other camps. On April 29th, 1945, 79 years ago, the United States Army, including the 12th Armored Division, liberated the camp at Dachau. There's been volumes written about the concentration camps and the Holocaust. But what I want to talk about is what the first soldiers saw when they got there. The 12th Armored Division wasn't even activated till 1942. What does that mean? It didn't exist until the war started, basically. They weren't part of the initial invasion on D-Day. The 12th Armored Division arrived in France around in November of 1944. The war wasn't over, but Germany hadn't fallen, so that meant that the 12th Armored Division had to fight their way into Germany. They took an amazing 72,000 German POWs. In the process, the 12th Armored Division also took heavy casualties, 3,500 battle casualties, over 600 killed in action, 2,400 wounded, 17 missing, and 478 prisoners of war. But they weren't done. They were just beginning. By late April, the unit arrived at Dachau. What did they find? I read a bit about Dachau, including a letter written home to his wife by one of the soldiers from the 12th Division. She must have told him that Roosevelt had died because he said that Roosevelt's death was insignificant compared to what he saw at Dachau. He said that when they got to Dachau, they found that many of the buildings had been burned down, probably not very surprisingly, considering that it was a war zone. But what they realized as they got closer is that they had burned down the buildings with people in them. And he went on to describe the scene and the smell in incredible detail. Here's my point that I would like to burn into your mind right now. Society had deteriorated to about the lowest point possible. I think everybody would agree on that. It was so bad that it overshadowed the death of President Roosevelt. Think about this a second. This guy comes from the United States. He lands in France. He fights his way into Germany. Massive world. We're obviously aware of what's going on. Huge historic events. He walks through the gates thinking what? We may never know, but probably not at all prepared for what he was about to find. And what he described, he said that, look, that the death of President Roosevelt was completely insignificant in the face of all this. What he saw when he went through the gates of Dachau overshadowed the 72,000 POWs that he had seen his unit take. It overshadowed the 3,500 casualties that his own unit had experienced. It wasn't even the 32,000 emaciated prisoners at Dachau that they liberated. It was the burnt bodies that he said he would never forget. Either way, you have to agree, it was a very dark time in history. If the way we judge humanity is by the way we treat other people, look at how the nations were treating other nations. And now I want to make a special point about all this. You take a look at the 12th Division and their actions in all this. They had to fight in, witnessing all this carnage across a continent. Then they had to care for the 72,000 POWs that they took in. You see, you don't just take the POWs and do what? Shoot them or kick them to the side. That's not how we did it. They have to feed them. They have to care for them. They have to keep them secure. They get to Dachau, the final, that wasn't the final destination, but the end destination, if you will. They're going to be, you know, supposed to be, you know, coming over the tipping point, if you will. But it was exactly the opposite. Now they got to deal with 32,000 very, very sick prisoners that they had to care for and get medical treatment and food, of all things. If that wasn't enough, they had to clean up the mess, the dead bodies that were left there. Interestingly enough, after everything that the 12th Division did, all the work that they did, the people that they saved, the compassion by the thousands, there's a rumor of a scandal by the 12th Division. They say there was a German village where American soldiers supposedly shot German POWs. Well, isn't it amazing that through all the carnage, all the lives saved by the 12th Division, and yet this is what's on their record? I have no idea what happened there, but I can say it's not at all what's reported. How can I say that? Because it never is. These guys fought through hell, uncover mass atrocities, then they get criticized for the way they did it. Well, how many times have we heard this story, right? Pretty much every time. Blame the veteran for all of society's failures. Think about what the world was look like to live through all that. All that had happened, a world war on two fronts. That same time, listen to how significant this timing was. April 29th, the date that it is today, 1945. At the same time that the 12th Army Division was liberating Dachau, the 4th Marine Division was fighting a final counterattack on Iwo Jima. I talked about this about 6 weeks ago on the show we did on Iwo Jima. It's a little-known story. After all the Iwo Jima fighting was done, people in America are celebrating with statues and flags, and the 4th Marine Division was still fighting, taking heavy casualties. And at the exact same time all that was going on, the Army's arriving at Dachau. Amazing, really, to think that both events took place at the same time. And it gives you an idea of how much hate and hostility there was in the world. Here's a little more detail on what happened. From 1933 to 1945, Nazi Germany operated more than 1,000 concentration camps. I read that number. It was mind-blowing to me. 27 main camps and more than 1,100 satellite camps. Amazing infrastructure when you think about it. There would have been about 186 at the end of 1943, 341 or more in June of 1944. By the time the Army got to Dachau, there were 662 active operating camps in Germany. This is massive. About 1.65 million people were registered prisoners of the camp. Nearly a million died due to their imprisonment. The number of survivors at those camps was no more than 475,000, meaning less than half walked out of there alive. Amazing, really. According to the estimate, at least 800,000 of the murdered prisoners were not Jewish. But this still leaves another 800,000 or more that were. This is the official account. In addition to the registered prisoners who died, a million Jews were gassed upon arriving in Auschwitz. These included victims, and a total death toll is estimated at 1.8 to more than 2 million. On April 26, 1945, as American forces approached, there were 67,000. Listen to these numbers. It's staggering. On the day that the American forces were set to liberate Dachau, 67,000 registered prisoners. More than half of that number were at the main camp. Of these, 43,000 were characterized as political prisoners, while 22,000 were Jewish, and the remainder falling into other categories. To this, it is amazing. Germans forced more than 7,000 prisoners, mostly Jews, on a death march from Dachau to, I can't pronounce this, Tangersee. I'm probably not saying that right, far to the south. During the death march, the Germans shot anyone who could no longer continue. Many died of hunger, cold, and exhaustion. On April 29, 1945, American forces liberated Dachau. As they neared the camp, they found more than 30 railroad cars filled with bodies brought to Dachau, all in an advanced state of decomposition. In early May 1945, American forces liberated the prisoners who had been sent on the death march. As Allied troops moved across Europe in a series of offenses in Germany, they began to encounter and liberate concentration camp prisoners, many of whom had survived death camp marches into the interior of Germany. Soviet forces were the first to approach a major Nazi camp, reaching the camp near Lublin, Poland in July 1944. Surprised by the rapid Soviet advance, the Germans attempted to demolish the camp in an effort to hide the evidence of mass murders. The Soviets liberated Nazi camps at Auschwitz and Ravensbrück. U.S. forces liberated Buchenwald, Dora Mittenbaal, if I'm saying that right, Dachau, and Mauthausen camps. British forces liberated camps in northern Germany included Neuengamme and Bergen-Belsen, I believe is how you say that. The 12th Armored Division, also known as the Hellcats, was the United States Army division that fought in the European Theater of Operations during World War II from 1944 to 1945. Not even a full year of service over there. It's amazing what they saw. The division landed at Liverpool, England on October 2nd, 1944, arrived at La Havre, France on November 11th, 1944. The 12th Armored Division fought in France, Germany, and Austria and is known for liberating the subcamp of Dachau 1945. You know, there's not many World War II veterans left to talk about any of this. Not many people to capture this story at all. 16.1 million Americans served in the global conflict. Little more than 119,000 are still living as of this year, and that's according to the National World War II Museum, with an average of 131 dying each day. These stories are being lost. Whatever's being preserved is what we have now. We're not going to have it. And it seems that history is on a path to repeat itself, sadly. We're going to take a short break. When I come back, I want to talk a little bit about the shores of Tripoli, another story that occurred on this day. We'll talk about that and the man in the arena. You might have heard it, but it's worth a listen. We'll see you back shortly.
Surveyor, civil engineer, but if you're in business, own property, or developing real estate, you know how critical it is to your project to make sure that you get the best. Everything has to be done correctly. It's important that those details are exact to ensure the success of the project. Well, my good friend Michael Tacconelli from STA Engineering is the best there is. It was my first job when I got home from the Marine Corps working on a survey crew, while Michael back then was the party chief. We hit it off well because of his relentless, disciplined approach. It was something that I agreed with. And I learned a little bit about surveying, an ancient craft that's now done with modern tools, but it still requires a high level of skill and professional expertise. Michael and his team bring all three, skill, expertise, and of course, all the latest tools and technology. The entire package of surveying and engineering, allowing them to provide builders and developers, businesses and property owners with reliable survey, design, and engineering for land development projects in southeastern Pennsylvania. For your next project, you're going to want to make sure you have the best possible support. Do yourself a favor and hire Michael Tacanelli, STA Engineering. They're already serving some of the area's largest developers, and they've done work in just about every municipality in the county. STA Engineering. Ask for Michael Tacanelli. One of the things that's rewarding for me about producing this show is the historical significance. Imagine getting to know a guy who was with the Marines who landed the first tanks in Vietnam. It's an incredible story, the power and capability of Marine Expeditionary Brigades. And Joe Tyson Sr. was there, literally, the first tanks off the boat and onto the beaches of Vietnam. The deployment came as a surprise, and they had no idea how long it would last. He ended up there an incredible 18 months, all detailed and chronicled in 600 pages of powerful warfighting stories from the perspective of a ground-fighting combat Marine. He tells it all. A real inside look at the conflict, the campaigns, and the crews. A look inside the fighting spirit of the Marine Corps. Joe Tyson Sr. says it all. It's a book that you'll want to have in your personal library. It's called Unfortunate Sons. It's available on Amazon. Check it out. Unfortunate Sons. We had an opportunity to interview Joe here at our studio at WWDB. It was an incredible experience. You can listen to the interview at projectchaos.org. Don't forget to check out the book, Unfortunate Sons, by Joe Tyson Sr., available on Amazon. I want to take a moment to share a little personal recommendation with you. Although I've spoken at quite a few events now, I didn't have any good video of me actually speaking in front of people. When we scheduled the book tour, I wanted to get some good video. Well, we reached out to a company called MAV, stands for Media, Art, and Video. I'm going to tell you, if you need any video, print design, or art, I highly recommend you take a look at what they have to offer at officialmav.com. That's officialmav.com. Media, Art, and Video. They did a great job for us. Of course, they covered all the basics of being there on time, highly organized and ready for the event. But they really went above and beyond, capturing great video, making adjustments where needed, making sure that the final product was a perfect 10. I'm happy to say they really delivered on that. If you need video of any kind, media, design, be sure to check out officialmav.com. That's officialmav.com.
The man in the arena. It's not the critic who counts. Not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat.
That was 35 years prior to the liberating of the concentration camps, and I think it's wildly important to tie these two events together. President Roosevelt gave a speech called The Man in the Arena. It was part of a small part of an overall speech. It was a very important statement that he was making, and little could he have known how important it would become 35 years later in World War II. To understand what he was saying, it's important to understand what was going on at the time. After the Civil War came the industrial period, factories and production lines. There was a lot of real tangible progress brought on by capitalism. Vehicles, phones, electricity wasn't even that old at that point. Imagine what it was like flying in the very first airplanes all the work that was being done, building railroads, bridges, and airports, all the manufacturing affecting people around the world. Listen to this. Americans who were born in the 1840s and 1850s would experience enormous changes in their lifetimes, some of those changes resulting from a sweeping technological revolution. Their major source of light, for example, would change from candles to kerosene lamps and then to electric light bulbs. They would see their transportation evolve from walking and horsepower to steam-powered locomotives to electric trolley cars to gasoline-powered automobiles. Born into a society in which the vast majority of people were involved in agriculture, they experienced an industrial revolution that radically changed the ways of millions of people, the way millions of people worked and where they lived. They would experience the migration of millions of people from rural America into the nation's rapidly growing cities. That was the state of affairs, but not everyone was happy with the changes that came about from all that. Many workers were typically unemployed at least part of the year. Their wages were low, and when they did work, they had trouble getting by. The situation led many workers to support and join labor unions. Meanwhile, farmers also faced hard times as technology and increasing production led to more competition and falling prices for farm products. Hard times on farms led many young people to move to the city in search of better job opportunities. Americans struggling with the change to an industrialized economy. Corporations wielded vast economic and political power, and the gap between the rich and poor widened. Underpaid workers toiled in hazardous conditions living in crowded cities. It was all foreign to people that grew up mostly on farms. In 1901, Vice President Theodore Roosevelt assumed the presidency after William McKinley was assassinated. After his presidency ended, he went on a speech tour. The speech, known as The Man in the Arena, is most famous for this section. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at least knows in the end of the triumph of high achievement, and who, at worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who never knew victory nor defeat. Almost really like a rallying cry, right? That he never knew that he was making, probably. He was pointing out what? He was pointing out that it's easy to criticize others. We have mouthpieces everywhere. But it takes real courage to be the person who's actually in the arena, facing those challenges head on. Whether it's in the workplace, in relationships, or personal growth, we all face these challenges, make us feel like giving up from time to time. And I have to wonder, as I look back on everything that was going on, speaking of giving up, how important these words would have been to the men on Iwo Jima, the men at Dachau. How different it would have been if they weren't motivated to take action. Like what? Like the millions of people that stood by while others were being loaded onto trains and taken into concentration camps and horrible things taking place while people, in many cases, engaged in it because they were fearful, they were afraid. Well, the Marines, the Army that went into the conflict, they didn't have that problem. They had a different approach. And I have to believe that at least part of it was this way of thinking, that men of action were valued, that it was important, and it was critically important to the world at that time. Think about what would have happened if the Marines and the United States Army had not fought in World War II. How different would things be today? What would be the real body count? What would be the way, what would the world look like today? How would it be different? We could only imagine. That part of that speech was only one small part of the speech. And I think it's an interesting comparison. You take a look at what's going on then and what he said in response. And it might not have seemed like it at the time, but he saw a world that was headed for trouble. And his speech was very telling in that regard. He talked about war, for example. Here's what he said. There are well-meaning philosophers who declaim against the unrighteousness of war. They are right only if they lay all of their emphasis on the unrighteousness. War is a dreadful thing. An unjust war is a crime against humanity. But it is such a crime because it is unjust, not because it is war. The choice must ever be in favor of righteousness, and this is whether the alternative be peace or whether the alternative be war. The question must not be merely, is there to be peace or war? The question must be, is it right to prevail? Are the great laws of righteousness once more to be filled? And the answer from a strong and viral people must be yes, whatever the cost. Every honorable effort should always be made to avoid war, just as every honorable effort should always be made by the individual in private life to keep out of a brawl, to keep out of trouble. But no self-respecting individual, no self-respecting nation can or ought to submit to wrong. I don't know how anybody could agree with that, but somehow we see things today going off the rails, don't we? What's the point of all this? Do what's right, even when it means making tough choices. And it's a big reason why I say we need to listen to the voice of our veterans right now, because veterans know what it's like to make those tough choices. Like what? Like arriving at Dachau to a mass murder scene that you neither had nothing to do with nor wanted anything to do with, but there you are, and now you make a decision. You make a decision to either turn and run or curl up into a little ball, or you fight and you continue to move ahead. And I'll say it again. What would have been different if the American Marines and American soldiers had not entered the conflict of World War II? What would be the body count from the 70 to 80 million that's recorded in history now? How many would have died? Theodore Roosevelt, in that speech, he talked about something else. Personal responsibility. Well, look at that. He said, we must ever remember that no keenness or subtleness of intellect, no polish, no cleverness in any way make up for the lack of great solid qualities. You can't polish a turd, I think is the saying. He said, self-restraint, self-mastery, common sense, the power of accepting individual responsibility, and yet of acting in conjunction with others, courage and resolution, these are qualities which mark a masterful people. Without them, no people control itself or save itself from being controlled by the outside. He was emphasizing the need to what? To be self-reliant, practically and otherwise, emotionally, physically. All of these matter. He spoke about human rights. And think about this. This was quite a few years before the war broke out, but it's like he had almost had a crystal ball that he understood what was going. He certainly had to see the flames being fanned at the very least. On human rights, this is what he said. He said, in every civilized and great society, property rights, he said, must be carefully safeguarded. Ordinarily, and in great majority of cases, human rights and property cases are fundamentally and in the long run identical. But when it clearly appears that there is a real conflict between them, human rights must have the upper hand, for property clearly belongs to man and not man to property. So he was drawing a little ideological difference for the crowd at that time. But I'll say this, how can we possibly be free without land? And that's ultimately what war is about. Land, taking, keeping, building, protecting, it's all part of the conflict. And I agree, it should be avoided at all costs. But when you have an organization that's engaged in indiscriminate killing of any kind, I think you'd have to agree that if necessary, we're going to take up force to end that. It must happen that way. This, I thought, was very interesting as we look around at today's media. Here's what he said about media and journalism. This is huge. This should be really written above like the door to the New York Times and all these news agencies. Here's what Teddy Roosevelt said. He said, all journalists, all writers, for the very reason that they appreciate the vast possibilities of their profession, should bear testimony against those who deeply discredit it. Offenses against taste and morals, which are bad enough in a private citizen, are infinitely worse if made into instruments for debauching the community through a newspaper. Mendacity, slander, sensationalism, inanity, I don't know what that word means, are all potent factors of the public mind and conscience. The excuse advanced for vicious writing that the public demands it and that the demand must be supplied can no more be admitted than if it were advanced by purveyors of food who sell poisonous adulterations. Journalists and writers should stand against those who discredit their profession, indeed. But listen to what he said, that a lying media is as destructive as selling poisonous food. And I think to myself, as I see what's going on today, there's a huge controversy on the protests going on our college campuses, as there should be a discussion about all that, and it's going to need to be dealt with. But I'll say to you, how about the role of the lying media today? Why do they get a free pass? We all sit there and know what's going on. We sit there and watch it, and we come to accept it. Teddy Roosevelt says a lying media is destructive as selling poisonous food. But somehow today, we accept these things as being okay. Some of the news of 1910 was very interesting. There was a lot of interesting things going on. There was a bakery strike. There was fears of no bread. And this would have been around the time that Teddy Roosevelt was giving the speech. The first muscle transplant, the era of modern medicine, a lot of that resulting from technology that came about as a result of the Civil War. There was an article here we didn't get to. There was some technological advancements from the war in Afghanistan. They have these clotting devices that are just revolutionary, really. It's amazing the inventions that will come out of war. I'm not trying to romanticize it or make it sound like a good thing, but it is one of the benefits that we see. And a lot of that was happening in the early 1900s. Freight costs were way down at that time. I'm just trying to describe to you how things were changing. And you look at how things are changing today. I'm not saying the changes were bad, but how we manage the changes, and we can't give up on things that we know to be true, things that we know to be right. And that's what you see happening today, this breakdown. But in addition to the other advancements that were going, travel was a huge one. And one of them was rail travel. Freight costs were down by half because of all the efficiencies of rail travel. I mean, think about if you had to move a product, say like a motor or a crankshaft or something used for industry, a saw blade. There you go. We had a lot of saw blades in use at that time. Let's say you got to take a large saw blade that you made in Philadelphia and you got to get it down to, I don't know, the woods down in North Carolina. Well, without trains, without a highway system, that was a big deal. As they built the railroads, it was a big deal that this created the freedom that people could exchange in commerce in all kinds of places. President Taft was talking about peaceful triumphs. I thought that was kind of funny. The United States was building railroads in Turkey. I thought that was very interesting, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of them are still in service today. At that time in 1910, this blew my mind. New York City was still being developed. It wasn't all that long ago, just a little over 100 years ago, many of those skyscrapers were being built at that time. And here's one thing that I noticed because I went and looked myself. That news at that time was very high quality. I went back to the 1910 newspapers and I looked, and it was amazing to me. They actually dealt in this thing called facts and information. We don't see a whole lot of that today. But yet, Roosevelt was issuing a big, big warning. And this was occurring after his presidency was over, saying to be careful of a lying media. How does all that compare to today? What are many people saying today? Similar things to what Roosevelt was saying. 4 years after he said all this, the world was mired down in World War I. The result would be 80 million deaths around the world. Amazing, really. At least a few people listened to him. At least a few understood what he was saying and went on to make things right. And we had the world that we had, at least until a little while ago. But we need to be careful, and it might be a good idea to listen to what Roosevelt had to say even today. What did he say? He said, it's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up short again and again. Because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at least best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who never knew victory nor defeat. What's the point? Despite the chaos and confusion, we know what's right, and we know how to take action. The rest is up to us. We're going to take a little break here. April 29th is the date that the United States Army liberated Dachau, the same time Marines fighting on Iwo Jima. It's also the date that we withdrew from Vietnam. We're going to talk about that as well as the Battle of Derna when we come back in just a minute.
Here's a little story I like. like to tell. About 6.5 years ago now, on a whim, I decided to start a podcast. I've been doing it about every day since then, but there's something else I want to tell you. When I got into it, I had a lot of experience listening to all the top names for many, many years, and one of the things I observed is that they had all written books. So when I started broadcasting, I knew one of the things I needed to do was write a book. And I started to write a book that I never finished. I got distracted. I read a lot to prepare for the podcast and this radio show. That includes books and articles. And the one book I was reading was Common Sense by Thomas Paine. And it was incredibly difficult to read in Old English. Words we don't use and a manner of speaking we no longer use. So as I read through it, I would look up the words I didn't understand and research the phrases. And I did this. I made notes, essentially creating a version in modern English. It took several months to complete this as I painstakingly worked to ensure that the meaning was preserved exactly as Thomas Paine wanted it. And finally, I did. I published The Common Sense in Modern English. The reviews have been fantastic, and people who read it agree it's a much better way to read it. Shortly after I wrote that, people began to ask me, what is common sense anyway? So I did a lot of research and couldn't find much, so I wrote a book on that too. It's called Common Sense, How to Get It Even If You Don't Know What It Is. Part of my many years listening to talk radio included broadcasters in the self-help genre, people like Dr. Jim Corey, who used to broadcast from WWDB way back in the 70s, and people like Earl Nightingale, a Marine veteran and father of the self-help industry. Those names motivated me, giving my experience as a Marine, I had a lot to offer in this area of expertise. And finally, I did write a book. It's called Be the Lion, The Secret to Massive Accomplishment. Over the years, people often ask me, how do I juggle so many things? All the answers are in that book. But there's one more thing. It's the story of the Marines at the Battle of Kafji, my newest book, and you don't want to miss it. You'll be inspired, and you'll learn what it means to fight to the death. And of course, all my books are available on Audible. I'd appreciate if you go check them out at projectchaos.org. And remember, books make great gifts. Project Chaos started on the premise that we were going to reveal the truth about what had happened in certain historical events, particularly related to our military and our veterans. And it's been a real success. I'm happy to report some of the interviews absolutely blown away any expectations I ever had when we started getting into this already. And we're just 10 coming up on 11 weeks here. Important thing that I wanted to mention is that all the support that we've received has been phenomenal. Everyone who's emailed and purchased the books and shared images and links on social media, it's all been fantastic. And that support is really helping to get the word out. Now, I want to make sure I took a moment to ask you directly to please continue to support us as best you can. As much as you can share the links to the show out on social media, the videos are a fantastic way to do that, to introduce people to what we're doing here, making introductions if you know any veterans, and certainly buying our books and magnets. And to those who can, we do offer the ability for one-time and monthly support. It's not really in the plan long-term to have a listener-supported model, but at this particular juncture, with all the work, time, and resources going into this, as we build up a certain momentum, your support is critical to ensuring that we can continue this. If you could, go visit projectchaos.org, grab a couple videos, share them out on your social media accounts, buy a book, buy a magnet, and if you can, please support the show. You'll see support right in the menu. It's our goal to be helping veterans, not to be a burden, but this support is critical at this time. Thanks for your consideration, thanks for your listen, and thanks for helping and spread the word. It means a lot.
April 29th, 1975 was the end of Vietnam. Interesting date, and I'm interested in how many of the dates of our shows correspond with these important historic dates. It's a great opportunity here to speak about it. Before we get into the withdrawal from Vietnam, which we have a lot of great stuff to offer there from some of the recent interviews we've done, but I want to mention another little historical event that went on at the same time. That was on the shores of Tripoli. Certainly you remember that line from the Marines' hymn, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. And it was born out of the Battle of Derna, which ended on April 27th, 1805. The United States Marines won the Battle of Derna, a key victory in the First Barbary War that occurred from 1801 to 1805. That battle took place on the shores of Tripoli in North Africa, and was the first battle for the United States Marines, as well as the first time the United States flag was raised on foreign soil. The battle took place after a 400-mile force march from Alexandria, Egypt, across North Africa to Derna, overcoming mutiny, hunger, thirst, and religious tension before arriving on April 25th. The Marines were led by diplomat-turned-general William Eaton, who hoped to free 307 American hostages held in Derna. Let me tell you what was going on at that time, and this has another interesting historical reference as we look at what's going on today. The waterways there around Tripoli were being interrupted by pirates. And this was in terms of the progress of the country, the progress of the world, the move to capitalism. It relied on being able to ship things around the world freely, to be able to freely engage in commerce. And it's an important freedom, if you think about it, because if you can't trade and you can't earn a living, suddenly life changes context quite quickly. Well, that's where the U.S. Marines became involved, as they were stopping the legendary Barbary pirates of North Africa from hijacking American ships. William Eaton set out on a secret mission to overthrow the government of Tripoli. In 1801, President Thomas Jefferson ordered the United States Navy and the United States Marine Corps to regain control of the Mediterranean. The pirates were demanding tribute from foreign nations for safe passage through the Mediterranean. In other words, they were going to charge fees or probably kill them. American ships became a common target, which incited anger among United States citizens. Well, I believe it would. You send your ship out to trade with North Africa or whatever nation, it's loaded with all these expensive goods, and halfway over there, they stop at a port and the pirates take over and rob them or shoot them or take everything or sink the ship or whatever they were doing. So the United States decided to go to war to release this hold on the area. And it was brutal, really. It was a true test of the United States Marine Corps. A lot of these conversations tie in with things that we're talking about today. That early amphibious landing and a 400-mile deep march. Ironically, the idea of making an amphibious landing 400 miles away is something that was done in Afghanistan by General Mattis. And he was bragging that the Marines absolutely could do it. And obviously, it was not done by force march at that time. It was all airlifted in, so it was a little bit different. But just to think about that a second, I don't know that many fighting forces would even engage in a project to force march 400 miles to go to battle. Just unbelievable when you think about it and the conditions. It was at the shores of Tripoli. It was at that Battle of Derna. Well, it was the Barbary Wars, really. But it was after all that was over that the Marines gained the nickname Leathernecks. And the Leathernecks was a leather collar on their uniforms that would protect against in cases of sword fighting, which a lot of this is how it was engaged in. It was just brutal fighting that took incredibly tenacious Americans to go break down these barriers that would allow a future world that included world trade that we see today. April 29th was also 1975, the date that the last citizens were evacuated from Vietnam, which basically ended the war for the United States. We learned a lot about Vietnam over the past couple of weeks, and some of it was interesting history that I wasn't completely aware of, at least not in the same way I was before after the interviews occurred. We talked to a Marine tanker. We also talked to an infantry Marine soldier. The tanker story was completely different than the Army infantry soldier's story. Two very different stories that came to a very similar ending, really magnificent in that regard. But it really speaks to the sacrifice of the American military in Vietnam. But the bigger part of the story is how we treated our veterans when they got home. To be spit in their faces, veterans literally hated by many people in this country. Those people are still here. Not any of them died in Vietnam. Not one of those spitting protesters ever died on the battlefield in Vietnam. And I said it earlier, if the measure of how great a society is measured by how we treat people. Well, how did we do with our veterans coming back from Vietnam? Think about it today. Those same people that think in that regard are still around today. And can you imagine whether you volunteered to serve, or especially if you were drafted, like John Podlosky? Can you imagine getting drafted, right? Joe Tyson, he volunteered to go in the Marine Corps. I don't believe that he deserved to be spit in his face any more than the guy who was drafted. But just imagine for a second, your number comes up. Now you got to make a decision. Are you gonna fight it? You're gonna go on the lam? I don't think that was a good option. They stepped up. They took their number. Some of the guys that stepped up in the draft, you know, what happened in most of these circles, there's two stories of what happened. The guys got drafted. They got in there. I think there was probably two waves. I'm sure it wasn't always the same. But they would go report to the draft, and then they would do one of two things. They would either say, okay, numbers, you know, whatever through whatever, move to the right. You're going in the Marine Corps. The rest of you are going in the Army. But then occasionally they would send and say, who wants to go in the Marine Corps? And many of those guys that got drafted volunteered for that, knowing what the situation that they were putting themselves into. Knowing what they were putting themselves into. Why? Because they were men of action, and they believed that it was important. And look around at what's going on today and tell me that it's not as important today as ever. But can you imagine whether you volunteered for that or you got sucked into it and forced to go and you come home to your own country and to be hated for it and to be spit on? I don't know that anybody really properly listened to the stories of the Vietnam veterans. And just like the 12th Regiment, they say, oh, they shot the Germans. They shot some Germans. They took 72,000 prisoner. But then they get to this one village and they just, what, decide to go on some rampant PTS-driven murdering spree? I don't think so. I'm not seeing that at all, right? The same unit that's going to go through and save over 30,000 POWs at Dachau, preserve the lives of 72,000 Germans on their way to doing it. They're just going to go through this one village and indiscriminately killing everybody. I don't think so. I find it hard to believe that the story went like that. And it's the same thing in Vietnam. You call these men baby killers. You talk about how they torched the villages. And you have no idea what you talk about. Go see it. Go experience it. And then come back and talk about it. And then we can have a conversation. But it's not just the spitting and the conversation that's the problem. It's the change in thinking. Do you understand? Listen to what Teddy Roosevelt was saying. He said, we're not going to put up with this crap. We're not the type of people that stand by and watch bad things happen to good people and just sit there and let it go on without doing something about it. That's not what good people do. The Marines, the United States Army, they stepped up in every one of these conflicts. Why? Was never once, not one of these conflicts started by the American military. Arguably Tripoli, I guess. They did go down there and start that one. But that's a different scenario as well. It wasn't our fight for the picking. We were being mistreated by another country. Vietnam, there were Vietnamese people being treated horribly. If you listen to the veterans and what they said, what do you think, they're making it up? It's all true. The American veterans, by and large, and I'm not saying bad things didn't happen, you go over there and sleep on the ground for a couple of months, get bitten by a snake, hit by shrapnel from a grenade, and then make every decision flawlessly. Of course, it's easy to sit there and Monday morning quarterback. Everybody wants to say something after it's over. Nobody had anything to say beforehand, except for Teddy Roosevelt. And that's the thinking that we need to carry into that. Not second-guessing ourselves, and certainly not blaming the veterans. Amazing, really. Well, at least the Marines at Tripoli, they weren't accused of any wrongdoings. So that's the history for today. Amazing, really, when you think about it. That in April 27th, just 2 days ago, all the way back in 1805, what is that, 200 years ago, and there was Marines fighting their first battle in the Middle East. Why? To preserve shipping lanes. Here we are now, 2024, we're having the same conversation. So if you ask yourself that the Marine Corps is important today, maybe you go back and look at what happened on April 27th, 1805. And the reason that I talk about it is that we want to avoid this loss of life on both sides. How do you do that? Through strong security, honoring the agreements, honoring boundaries, honoring territories, and making sure that the security is in place to maintain it. If there's no security in place to maintain it, you don't own anything. We don't have free shipping through the Middle East right now. We don't have free exchange with Russia. All these things are changing very quickly. And I think just like before World War II, you can see the run-up of this. It's not too late to stop. We can enter into a period of cooperation, settle the debts, settle the score, and avoid all of the loss of life. But that's not my decision. And that's not the decision of the young Marine or the young soldier. It's not how it works. I want to share a couple of things with you here before we wrap up for the day. I wanted to lay out the history because I think it's important to understand that history. You go from Tripoli in April, then you go to World War II, the liberation of the concentration camps. I don't get the sense that one soldier in Europe was ever prepared for a second. Maybe they didn't even know. Maybe nobody knew. I mean, you had German citizens that they say they didn't know what was going on. So how could American citizens really know what was going on? I didn't get the feeling that they went into these camps with much of an understanding what they were stepping into. And can you imagine the nightmares? Just imagine watching society upended like that. I'll tell you, it's something. I've seen it myself. When an entire country is destroyed and you say, what the heck happened that there's been such a failure of humanity that led it to this? But somehow, the blame gets shifted to the young Marines, to the young soldiers. How is that? I'll never know. I'll never know. Vietnam, 1975, pulling people off that rooftop. I can still remember it. I can. I was very young at that time. And you know what hurts my heart about all that? I'm no military historian. I'm no general. I'm no tactical expert at all. At all. But you know what? A week before it happened, with complete accuracy, I predicted exactly what was going to happen in Afghanistan. I said, there's going to be dead Marines, and sure enough. And damned if you don't know. Guess what I just saw come out? I have it somewhere. I didn't bring it today. I can't remember the station. I'll get it, though. Don't you know that they're trying to blame the Marines for what happened? They start replaying. I listen to this, and I'm no ballistic expert either, but I know what AK fire sounds like, and I know what 5.56 rounds sound like, and I know what they sound like going out and coming in. And those were not outgoing 5.56 rounds. And you remember me telling the story I talked about at Abbey Gate? I said, that Marine, he talked about that kid sitting on that container. Do you remember me going on? There's something to that. What the hell was the kid doing on the container? They were shooting at him. And you're in a mob of civilians. What were they supposed to do? They never fired back. I've looked at all the footage. I saw no evidence of any firing back. The control that those Marines exhibited was unbelievable. People in the crowd were throwing their babies, Afghan babies, to these are Marines from a MU. These are trained killers, not babysitters. They go into places like Tripoli and kill bad guys. That's what they're designed to do. But they're going to blame them for what happened at Abbey Gate. It makes me sick. I don't think that story's going anywhere, thank God. We're going to run out of time, but let me share a couple things with you to wrap up. I saw this article in Army Times that a friend gave me, because I don't subscribe to Army Times. I'm kidding around. It's a great magazine. A friend did give me. But this one article particularly caught my attention. It has a photo of a firing M1 Abrams. Why wouldn't that catch your attention? It's called Thunder of Doom, and here's the story. A terminally ill Army veteran got his final wish to relive his tank gunner days. It's really amazing when you look at the story, and here's why I brought it up. I was down at the VA getting my hearing aids. I know you're tired of hearing me talk about it. I won't go into that story again. But the doctor said something significant to me. She said, you know, it's amazing, you guys. All these veterans in here, they're all broken up. She said, but you ask any one of them, would you do it again? They all say without any hesitation, I sure would. This is amazing. This guy's going to die. He may be dead by now, for all I know. Jay Tennyson, a former tanker battling stage 4 stomach cancer, visited Fort Moore, Georgia in December to fire his final shot from the Abrams main battle tank. Upon his diagnosis of 12 to 18 months to live, Tennyson reached out to his Army network to make his wish of feeling the thunder of doom from inside the tank a last time reality. I thought that was really, really remarkable that this was the last thing that this guy wanted to do. Of all the things that he could have chosen, a special meal, a special time with his family, and what did he do? He wanted to go back inside that tank. He wanted to go relive those incredible memories. Why? I don't know. You'd have to ask him. But you know, Ronald Reagan talked about this, and it's the purpose of our American military. It's an important purpose, and it means something. And these guys are so committed to it all the way until their last days. I wanted to share this too. This comes out of another great publication, At Ease Veterans Magazine. And I'm not going to share all this with you. This is written by a 21-year Air Force veteran nurse. Fantastic article. She said during her last job, she saw the stress that service members transitioning to the civilian world were under. This led her to co-author her first book, Warrior to Patriot Citizen, focused on ensuring service members are prepared for transition. Whoo, having trouble with that. Well, before transition occurs. She retired and is out of the military as of 30 September 2022. And she has this book, and now she wrote this article, which is really fantastic. Air Force veteran Donna Hoffmeyer. And she wrote this article. It says, six things that should make veterans go, and thoughts on reflection and growth. And she does an incredible job, I think, capturing a lot of what I like to try and share here on Project Chaos. Some of the fundamental ways that we as veterans think that are valuable in the civilian world, valuable in our lives. She talked about accountability. In other words, owning our mistakes. I found myself in the civilian world, that doesn't happen the same way. Not making assumptions, right? Taking in all the information. Little details, like something out of place as minor as a child sitting on a sea container and how significant that can be. Looking at different bias and how those bias can affect our thinking. Emotional intelligence that I talk about, the whole theme of the chaos that we're able to see clearly through this chaos as veterans, we've been trained for it. There's so much to it, but here's what she said, the last comment. She said, you are not responsible for the trauma you incurred. You are responsible for healing from the trauma. You are a warrior. That doesn't end. We got to keep fighting the fight. And I know it's hard, but we got to keep doing it. God willing, we'll be back next Monday. Sure hope to see you there. Make it a great day.